Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and I'm glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we will be talking some about the life and work and ideas of Leonardo da Vinci. Now, probably most people today will think of da Vinci as an artist, and certainly with good reason. He is, after all, responsible for one of the best-known images in all of Western art, the Mona Lisa. But in addition to being an artist, he was also a scientist. And in fact, says our guest for this hour, Fritjof Capra, Leonardo was in many ways the unacknowledged father of modern science. He makes the argument that while he certainly did approach science with the eyes of an artist, he also pioneered the empirical approach to the observation of nature, this method that we now call the scientific method. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with Fritjof Capra about his new book. It's titled The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. The book has just recently been published. It's published by Doubleday. I'm sure you can find it out in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Just a little bit more about our guest. Fritjof Capra is author of four international bestsellers, The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, Uncommon Wisdom, and The Web of Life. He has co-authored a number of other books. He holds PhD in theoretical physics from the University of Vienna and has done research in particle physics at a number of places, the University of Paris, University of California, Santa Cruz, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and the Lawrence Berkeley Lab at University of California. He's also taught at UC Santa Cruz, UC Berkeley, and Sanford State. In addition to the research that he's done in physics, he has also for a long time been thinking about the philosophical and social implications of contemporary science. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, get in as many people as possible. Anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, over the internet, 333-9455, and that toll-free is 800-222-9455. Dr. Capra, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. As you point out in the book, certainly a great deal has been written about da Vinci, but this particular part of his life, that is, da Vinci as scientist, you say, really has not gotten very much attention. And perhaps we'd begin with the question, why? Why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, well, that was the big surprise to me. You know, I became interested in the science of Leonardo da Vinci many years ago, in fact, in the 1970s, at the time when I wrote my first book, The Tao of Physics. I came across a quotation of his where he describes his empirical method, and I realized then, or I assumed, that he should really be seen as the founder of modern science, as the first scientist in the modern sense. And I didn't do anything about it. I kept up my interest. I went occasionally to exhibitions of his drawings and marveled at his drawings of how he compared patterns in different phenomena. And when I became serious about writing this book about 4 years ago, I started to read the literature, and I found that there are surprisingly few books about Leonardo's science. Among the hundreds of books that have been written about him, there are no more than about five or six books about his science. And the reason is not easy to see. One reason is that most of these books are written by art historians or biographers who are not scientists, and who find it difficult to understand his science and to evaluate it. Another reason is that his scientific notes are very widely dispersed in his notebooks. He left about 13,000 pages of manuscripts when he died, and about half of those got lost over the centuries, but we still have about 6,500 pages. And you have to really search for his scientific notes and, you know, pull them together. Not many people have done that.
You have chosen, and I think that the quote that you're talking about for the epigraph for the book, this quote from da Vinci, from sometime perhaps in the 16th century?
Early 16th century.
And he says, he writes here, "First I shall do some experiments before I proceed further, because my intention is to cite experience first, and then with reasoning show why such experience is bound to operate in such a way. And this is the true rule by which those who speculate about the effects of nature must proceed." And that is indeed, in brief and complete, the scientific method. You think that really no one... Perhaps some people had been doing it, but as far as anybody can tell, that's the first time has anyone had actually set that down as the basic way they were going to proceed.
Yeah, it's sort of like Leonardo's scientific manifesto. But, of course, that's not all there is to the scientific method. And so I did much more and really researched it, and I have a whole chapter about his scientific method. You know, what he did in addition was... in his systematic experiments, for example, he would vary the parameters. When he did optical experiments, he would shine light on bodies. He would use first one lamp, then two or three. He would use a sphere, and then a cylinder, and then a cone, and so on. And he says in his comments, you have to do this. You have to make repeated experiments to eliminate errors and to... elucidate the essential characteristics of the phenomenon you study. Now, this is very modern. This is really what scientists do today, systematic experiments. Mm.
Well, that's you say that he was what today we would call a systemic thinker.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, this means that whenever Leonardo looked at a problem, he would, or studied a phenomenon, he would link it to phenomena in other areas. So he would compare, for example, he would draw the leg of a man and the leg of a horse and see the similarities in the structure. On one sheet in the Windsor collection, a beautiful sheet that I have reproduced in the book, he draws the expression of rage in a man, in a horse, and in a lion. Now, art historians talk about analogies, and they say reasoning by analogy was common in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and that is true. But in those cases, we are talking about more than analogies. It's what biologists call homologies, that is, similarities of anatomical structure that we now know go back to a common ancestor and to a relationship in evolution. Now, Leonardo didn't know about evolution, but he realized the similarity of patterns in living systems. Mm. Let me give you another example. Mm-hmm. He talks about the flow of water and the branching of rivers. He compares it to the branching of the flow of sap in plants and trees and the branching of human arteries in the flow of blood. Now, this is what we call systemic thinking.
And certainly another feature of his work, when you look at the volume of material that he left behind, was that he stunningly illustrated this work with drawings by his own hand. And he was
yes.
he was magnificent in this. You also say, and I think that this is strikes me as an important point and something we should talk about, this idea that you cannot understand one without the other. That is, you can't understand him as an artist or as a scientist. Those two things can't be understood apart.
Right. I mean, this is my basic thesis. And as you said in your introduction, David, he approached science with the eyes of an artist. Now, the key sentence that I found in Leonardo's writings is when he says, "Painting embraces within itself all the forms of nature." So he approached the forms of nature to paint them. And he thought that in order to paint them properly, he really had to study them. In another passage, he says, "Painting with philosophic and subtle speculation considers all the qualities of forms. Truly this is science, the legitimate daughter of nature, because painting is born of nature." So in order to paint nature, Leonardo had to study it. And then the question arises, how do you record the results of your observations of organic forms, of living forms and transformations accurately in a scientific way? Well, today we use mathematics, and Leonardo tried that, but the mathematics available at his time was Euclidean geometry. And of course, you can't use, you know, triangles and squares to describe the growth of a plant. So he used his extraordinary talent of drawing, his artistic ability to record his observations. And this is the very tight connection between his art and his science.
Just perhaps one more thing. There, for a long time in science, in the history of science, it was, and this is something that I suppose scientists still perhaps argue about, there was this attitude toward nature and, in a sense, toward all living things that said essentially the universe, nature as we know it, the earth, animals, human beings, are all in one way or another machines. And that's the way that we can understand it, a very kind of a mechanistic view of life and of living things. And what is striking about Leonardo, and why I think a lot of people would be interested in his approach, is that that was not his approach. It was not a mechanistic view of the of living things and of the world.
No, not at all. Of course, we must realize that the mechanistic view arose with the scientific revolution, with Galileo, Bacon, Newton, Descartes. That was, 100 to 200 years later than Leonardo. At his time, nobody thought of the Earth as a machine. The view of the Earth as a living organism was common, had been handed down from antiquity, was formulated first by Plato, and was well known in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. But what is unique about Leonardo is he treated the world as a living system, and the living forms, the organic forms in the world at large and in the human body, from the point of view of science, and he approached them with his scientific method. So what I do in the book is also to show that Leonardo had very deep ecological awareness. I present Leonardo the ecologist and also the eco-designer, because he always used nature as a mentor and a model and patterned his own designs after those of nature. So all this makes him very relevant to our time.
Certainly this view is one that is gaining currency once again. Maybe it never went away completely, but it was a minority viewpoint, and now I think more people are willing to embrace it.
Yes, there's a sort of, a swing of the pendulum. There was an organic view in the Middle Ages, non-scientific but organic. Then came modern science with the scientific revolution. Then came the industrial revolution. And so that put forth a mechanistic view of the world, which lasted very long into the 18th and 19th century. And then in the 20th century, the pendulum began to swing back, but it still hasn't swung back for many people in medicine, for instance, where doctors often see the body as a machine, or in management, where managers see an organization as a machine, that can be engineered and fine-tuned and so on. So the mechanistic view is still around with us, and again, that's why Leonardo can be very inspiring.
Our guest is Fritjof Capra. He's a physicist who also has for a long, long time been interested in, written about, talked about some of the philosophical and social implications of science. He's the author of a number of very popular books, including The Tao of Physics, published in 1975. He's also been a teacher at UC Santa Cruz, UC Berkeley, San Francisco State. He's also done research in particle physics at a number of different institutions, does a lot of speaking and a lot of interviewing, and we're pleased that he can be with us this morning to talk about his most recent book, which is The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. That's the subtitle, and it is about the scientific thinking and ideas of Leonardo da Vinci. We have a caller ready to go, and others certainly who are listening are welcome to call in with questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Belgium, nearby community. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I wanted to ask you what kind of influence another Italian thinker, artist had to do with him. And pardon me if I totally destroy this poor man's name. Botticelli, is that his name?
Botticelli?
Botticelli, the fellow who did the dome in Florence.
No, that was Brunelleschi.
Brunelleschi, that's the person I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Now, didn't Leonardo go visit Florence and see his work and take things from it to improve his own situation?
Yes, yes. Well, Leonardo didn't only visit Florence. He lived in Florence. He started out there. He was born in Vinci in a small village, you know, about half an hour away from Florence today. And he went into his apprenticeship as a painter, a sculptor, and an engineer in the workshop of Andrea del Verrocchio. And he lived in Florence for, you know, 16 years or so, then moved to Milan, then went back to Florence. So he was always known as a Florentine in the Italian art world. And Brunelleschi lived maybe 50 years before Leonardo, so Leonardo did not know him. When Leonardo started his apprenticeship, that famous dome of the Cathedral of Florence had just been finished, you know, after the death of Brunelleschi, was actually not completely finished. And Leonardo was very influenced by Brunelleschi. In those days, many Renaissance painters were also engineers. Leonardo was not the only one. And in his youth, he copied many of the machines that Brunelleschi had invented, machines like cranes and lifts and hoists. And Leonardo, turning into a brilliant engineer himself, improved on many of these machines. But he always acknowledged his debt to Brunelleschi.
So Brunelleschi did lead him in the right path, though, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. This gets at what I think is a very interesting question, and that is, how is it, how does a mind like Leonardo's form? He did not have formal education in a sense. He didn't go to university. He learned by apprenticing himself to other people who were brilliant and talented, and perhaps there was something that he simply brought to it that he simply had. How does such a mind develop?
This is a really intriguing question, and I studied it for a long time and wrote about it in the first chapter of my book, and I didn't really find a convincing answer. What you can say is that Leonardo, whom we often call the archetypal Renaissance man today, was not the only person of this kind. In the Italian Renaissance, this ideal was known as the universal man, a person educated in many fields, possibly all fields of knowledge at the time. So, as I just said before, it was very common for painters to be also engineers, to be also poets, like Michelangelo, for instance, and to be sculptors or goldsmiths. Brunelleschi himself, by the way, started out as a goldsmith, and he was also famous as a sculptor. So this universal man was a common ideal. But what is unique about Leonardo is that he went further in all of these disciplines than others. And how this genius arose and why he became such a genius is not something really we can answer. In fact, you know, I read a couple of books by psychologists about the nature of genius, and they can identify some common characteristics in, say, Shakespeare, Newton, Mozart, Leonardo da Vinci. But why a certain person becomes a genius, nobody can say.
Hmm. He left behind tremendous volume of material describing his ideas and his scientific work and so forth. What he did not leave was anything, almost anything, that would be of a revealing personal nature. There were no journals. There was nothing where he sat there and talked about his daily experience, his relationships with other people, what he was thinking, what he was feeling, all those sorts of things that would give us some insight, at least that way, into his character.
That's very strange. Yes, Leonardo's notebooks, you know, thousands of pages, are partly, you know, scientific treatises or drafts for treatises, but partly also personal notes, not in the sense that you just meant, but in the sense that they contain shopping lists and they contain reminders to himself to borrow a book in a certain library and things like that. But there is hardly anything personal. There's hardly anything emotional. There are no comments about his relationship with his family, for instance, or, you know, with his lover. We know, and it is commonly assumed, at least, that Leonardo was gay, as was also Michelangelo. But whereas Michelangelo wrote love poems to his lovers and you know, published them, or at least made them available, Leonardo kept his feelings, his sexuality, his emotions completely secretive. And that's a general characteristic of his personality. He not only kept his feelings secret, but also his science, you know, to the detriment of the advancement of science. He didn't publish anything during his life, and unfortunately after his death, his notebooks were hidden for centuries, and it was only really in the 19th century that they were first transcribed and properly analyzed.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, because apparently as far as his what he knew about art and the techniques that he employed as an artist, he was certainly willing to share that.
Exactly. That's a strange thing, that, you know, he had disciples. You know, he published notes on painting, which were published actually after his death, but by his disciple Melzi, Francesco Melzi, according to Leonardo's instructions. So, you know, they were published in the 16th century, not long after his death. But his science he kept to himself. Now, we must also realize that Leonardo approached science on the one hand as a painter, but also as an engineer. And it was common among the engineers of the time, like Brunelleschi or Francesco Di Giorgio, other great Renaissance engineers, not to publish detailed drawings, because there were no patents, and their knowledge and skills were their intellectual capital. That's how they made their money, and they didn't want to divulge that. So Leonardo kept his engineering skills secret, and he somehow transferred this from engineering to his science.
And just, is it the case, though, that we suspect that he didn't necessarily intend to keep his scientific work secret forever, that he had the idea that he would himself edit, collect, organize the material, and that perhaps
right.
he just never got to it?
Yeah, that's right. There are several hints of conversations he had with people that are recorded or reported by others, and also notes in his notebooks that he intended to publish. He intended to write a collection of treatises, and he numbers them, he outlines them, and we have some of these treatises in rudimentary form. There is a little notebook called Codex on the Flight of Birds, which is a subject that fascinated Leonardo during his whole life, and he built all these flying machines and studied birds flying. And this little codex is almost in publishable form. And there's one on the flow of water, and there are others. But none of them completed and none of them published, because ultimately he always got interested in new things and, you know, new ventures, and didn't publish anything. Mm.
Again, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Fritjof Capra. He's the author of a number of very popular books, The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, Uncommon Wisdom, and The Web of Life. He's the founding director of the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley, California, and does a lot of writing and speaking, has for a long time now, about science. And he is author of a new book that looks at the scientific thinking and ideas of Leonardo da Vinci. And the title of the book is The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. It's published by Doubleday. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I think, well, at the same time, you have to acknowledge the fact that da Vinci was an exceptional person, and indeed may well be deserving of the title of genius. That is, he didn't come out of nowhere. He was indeed grounded in the worldview of the time. And I think, you know, an important point I'm sure that you would make is that science, no matter where or when you're talking about, science is linked. It reflects the values and the worldview of its time. So in what way was the cultural atmosphere in which da Vinci grew up and worked embodied in the ideas?
Yeah. Well, he, as I mentioned already, he grew up in this workshop culture in Florence, where artists were trained and educated not only as painters, but also as goldsmiths and as sculptors and architects. And in the famous workshops like the one of Verrocchio, they were also these workshops were also cultural centers where people would come in the evening and visit, because many new techniques of painting were developed in these workshops. When Leonardo was an apprentice, this was the time where oil painting had just been invented in Holland, and was or in Belgium, and brought to Italy and was studied there, and also often kept as a secret. So people came to Verrocchio to find the latest techniques. And also travelers came. This was the big time of exploration, where people traveled around the world for the first time. And many of these explorers would stop by in Verrocchio's workshop and tell their tales, and the young Leonardo would soak all this in. So he received this universal education. Then later on, when he became a scientist, like every true scientist, he studied the literature. One thing that I try to dispel in my book is the kind of myth that Leonardo was a solitary genius who did everything by himself. Mm-hmm. He was not only well-educated, but was also personally acquainted with the leading intellectuals of his time. You see, he was very famous as a painter already in his younger years, and it was easy for him to contact people. So he knew architects, engineers, politicians, historians. Just to name a few names, he knew the famous architect Bramante. He knew an anatomist, Antonio della Torre, a mathematician, Luca Pacioli, the famous writer and politician Machiavelli. Those were all acquaintances and friends of Leonardo. And in addition, he studied the literature, he studied the classical texts, and he built on them. He didn't feel that he needed to adhere to Aristotle, but whenever Aristotle's ideas were useful, he would use them. When they were not, when they were contradicted by his experiments, he would go beyond Aristotle. But he was grounded in the worldview of his time, and of course, in many ways, he went far beyond it.
Yeah, I find myself again going back and looking at the drawings that are reproduced in the book. And his skill at drawing was truly remarkable. And certainly, this was a time when then, and I suppose still now, part of artist training. If they're formally trained, it has to do with anatomy, because the idea is that if you don't to depict the human form and depict it accurately, you've got to understand musculature and the skeleton. You've got to know what's underneath the skin if you're going to accurately depict what it looks like on the outside. You've got to know like what it looks like on the inside.
Yes, absolutely.
And his drawings are just incredibly beautiful. How common was it indeed to do the kind of you would have to look at the real thing to be able to,
yes.
to do
well,
this.
First of all, I should add a note of gratitude to my publisher Doubleday, because these drawings are produced in a very beautiful way in the book. There are 50 sepia illustrations where you can see Leonardo's drawings, you know, in great clarity, and it's really a gorgeous production, so I'm very grateful for that. Leonardo did many dissections himself. He was close to a hospital in Florence where he was allowed to do dissections, which was not exactly illegal, but was sort of frowned upon. And in order not to cause any, you know, public annoyance, he did them at night. Now, of course, they didn't have electricity, so he did them by candlelight. And he describes, you know, in very vivid terms how gruesome this was. Mm. And they didn't have, you know, chemicals to disinfect the bodies, so they began to smell very soon. And he spent hours and hours in this semi-dark room with these corpses, and then produced these magnificent drawings that went far beyond anything anybody else had done. Other painters did dissections too. Michelangelo and others also dissected bodies, but Leonardo went far beyond. And also what is characteristic of Leonardo is that he began by showing the forms of nature, in this case anatomical forms of the human body, from the outside. But then he went deeper and he studied the causal relationships. He did not only want to find out how a certain muscle was shaped, but also why it was shaped, what the function was. Michelangelo never did that. Michelangelo was a very great anatomist and a genius in drawing and sculpting, especially the human body, but he never asked about the metabolism underlying the functions of muscles, and that's what Leonardo did. That's what makes him unique.
And when you look at the drawings, I think you don't doubt their accuracy. So you think, well, this certainly must be a very highly accurate representation of what the muscles look like and what the skeleton looks like. But somehow beyond that, beyond its technical veracity, you just have to sit there and wonder and say, or at least I find myself saying, these are beautiful.
They're gorgeous. They're works of art.
Yeah, and what though? I guess I can't. I don't know what it is exactly I'm responding to when I say that they're beautiful.
Well, you know, art historians, of course, have studied that, and what they say is there are two elements that are in Leonardo's anatomical drawings that are really impressive. One is that he shows the forms of the human body in perspective. When he draws a skeleton or when he draws muscles or nerves, he would show them as real objects in perspective, and he shaded them. He shows the light and shade on them. And I realized this when I began to study his anatomy. I'm not a biologist or medical doctor, and I know some anatomy back from school, but I had to talk to physicians, and I actually bought a copy of Gray's Anatomy, the standard textbook, to really see how Leonardo's drawings compare with what we know today. And I was struck by the fact that those drawings in Gray's Anatomy really look ugly compared to Leonardo's. Mm. Because, the aim of these illustrators was, in Gray's Anatomy, was to be completely accurate. And, of course, they used modern techniques of photography and whatnot. But, they were not, their aim was not to produce beauty. Leonardo can never separate the artist from the scientist.
Yeah. And something else that I think is striking about a lot of his drawings, and perhaps it is because they are drawings of organic forms out of nature, and that is that there is a lot of movement. He was very interested in movements and in the flow and currents of things, whether that be a natural body of water like a stream or a river, or whether that be the human blood flow through the veins of the body.
Yeah, absolutely. Leonardo went behind the appearance of forms, and he realized that in living forms, the way they are shaped depends on the underlying processes. And the underlying processes, very often, in the processes of metabolism and growth and development, are often processes of flow. And so he depicts nature as entirely dynamic. Any living form for him, in a sense, is just a stage in an ongoing process of change and transformation. And he shows this also in his geology, where he depicts rocks changing over long spans of time, what we now call geological time. So rocks are transformed by the action of water over extremely long periods of time. Plants are transformed by the flow of sap in them, by their growth and development. And the same is true for the human body. And he shows the human body in motion, the plants in motion, sometimes in exaggerated motion. There's one picture I have in a book about a plant called the Star of Bethlehem, and it shows a swirling, spiraling motion of the leaves, of the foliage, that is so exaggerated that the entire plant almost looks like a water vortex.
Yes.
And this is, Leonardo saw this as a symbol of life. He saw the spiral and the vortex as a symbol of life.
That's a beautiful drawing. I was just looking at it. I'm looking at it right here, and it is really stunning. And just for that reason that you describe it, I think, very well.
Yes, and actually he transferred this into his portraits. When you read, art historians about the portraits of Leonardo, then they will tell you that he introduced a spiral motion into the bodies of his sitters. You know, the face would look in one direction, a little spiraling away from the body. And that was a new technique that was then copied by Michelangelo and other painters later on. So he always saw the spiral or the spiraling hair. He has spiraling hair, the flow of hair compared to the flow of water. So, you know, in all of this, we see underlying forces and patterns that are common to all life. Again, this is why I call him a systemic thinker. Mm.
We have perhaps about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Vichov Capra. He's a scientist, a physicist by his academic training, but someone who has been for a long time interested in the social implications of contemporary science. He's authored a number of books, and maybe some people will still best know him for his first, The Tao of Physics, published in 1975. He's also been a teacher, and his new book is about Leonardo da Vinci and his scientific thinking, and the title of the book is The Science of Leonardo. It's published by Doubleday. We have been talking here about his interest in anatomy, the fact that he did dissection, looked at the body and its mechanics and how it was put together and did these beautiful and detailed drawings. One thing that he was particularly interested in, and maybe that's not surprising because he was an artist, he was particularly interested in the mechanics of vision.
Yes, and that is a fascinating subject that occupies the last two chapters of my book, and I call it Leonardo's Theory of Perception and Knowledge. He was, of course, interested in vision because, you know, he approached science from the point of view of a painter. The eye was his principal instrument, and here's what he writes about the eye. He says, "The eye, which is said to be the window of the soul, is the principal means whereby sensory awareness can most abundantly and magnificently contemplate the infinite works of nature." So he was interested in the eye both as a painter and as a scientist. So in this whole theory of perception and knowledge, he starts from the external appearance of objects. He studies perspective, which was the great innovation in painting in the Renaissance. He studies the nature of light and shadow, the way light rays hit an object and cast shadows, something that we now call geometrical optics. Then he goes on to ask himself, what is really the nature of light? And he hypothesizes correctly that light moves in waves, which was extraordinary for the time, 200 years before the wave theory of light was developed by Christian Huygens. Then Leonardo goes and follows the light rays into the eye. He studies the anatomy of the eye. He dissects eyes. He develops techniques that are still used today for the dissection of the eye, which is a very difficult organ to dissect. And he studies the lens, the eyeball, something, you know, that he draws something akin to what we now know as the retina. And then he follows the optical nerve into the brain, to the center of the brain, where he assumes to be the seat of the soul. And then he studies perception and knowledge, how the soul recognizes things and knows things. And I found that if you understand Leonardo's concept of the soul, which is that of a vital force that moves the body and also forms the body, When you compare this with our modern science of cognition, you can actually replace the word soul by cognition, and what he writes then about cognition is absolutely modern. So this is a huge sweep from the external objects back to neurophysiology and cognition, which today, you know, occupies five or six different disciplines of science, and Leonardo did it all in one big sweep. Mm.
Was Leonardo a religious man, or do we even know that?
We do know that. We do know that he was not religious. I would say he was spiritual in his awe of nature, in his reverence, in his, you know, passion for living things. He had a sort of earth-oriented, or what I would call now ecologically oriented, spirituality, but he was not fond of organized religion, which of course was Christianity in his time, in his the region where he lived, and he was sort of anti-clerical, But he kept these views very much to himself, like all his other views, but maybe even more so, because the church was one of his main patrons. He got commissions for all these religious paintings. He knew theology very well, and many of his paintings are theological meditations on the Bible and on various Christian teachings. But he very rarely talks about God. When he mentions God, it's almost sort of always sort of in a formal way, because it's the custom. But otherwise, he uses nature for him. So he had a kind of, you know, pantheism or something, you know, like Spinoza seeing God embedded in nature.
You talked about the fact that his. During his, and you write about, you write it here in the book, that during his lifetime, his scientific work was virtually unknown and continued to be unknown for more than 200 years after he died. In part, it might have been because he never really got the chance to organize it and present it in the way that he would have liked.
Right.
But one, and perhaps also because at the time there was this prevailing view in science that maybe you didn't share what you were doing with other people who might have been competitors in a sense.
Well, and also there was the church, you know, which
that's what I'm. What, yeah.
Tolerant in Leonardo's time, but, you know, 100 years later, look what happened to Galileo.
Well, that's my precise thought. We know that people like, and Galileo probably is going to be one of the first examples that will come to anybody's mind, that got into trouble because their ideas challenged the prevailing order. And that's one of the things that one wonders. I wonder about Leonardo, whether in fact some of his ideas would have been, in his time, would have been problematic.
Oh, yes, absolutely. They would have been. And actually, he did get in trouble with the Pope a little bit because of his ideas of the soul. And the precise point was that Leonardo saw the soul as always connected with the body, and he speculated about the soul of a fetus in the mother's womb, and he wrote that in a very beautiful passage that the soul of the mother is the guardian of the soul of the baby, and the soul of the baby matures until it becomes independent and then sort of separates itself from the soul of the mother. Now, this was not Christian doctrine at all. And when the Pope heard about that, he forbade Leonardo to do further dissections. So it was for a long time believed that the Pope didn't allow Leonardo to do dissections in Rome because it was, you know, against the rules of the church. But that's not true. Other people, medical doctors, did dissections. It was because of Leonardo's heretical views about the nature of the soul.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about his certainly his interests in anatomy, in the human body, in human perception, particularly vision, in his, the way he thought about nature and looked at it. How did that kind of thinking, when it came to the way that he approached mechanical devices, how did that inform the way that he thought about that?
I'm very glad that you bring this up, David, because I'm sitting here and I made a note to myself, mechanical instruments, because that's an important part.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very subtle point. Leonardo was a mechanical genius. He invented hundreds of machines and mechanical devices, but his worldview was not mechanistic. He didn't see the world as a machine. He didn't see the human body as a machine. Now, there are Leonardo scholars who disagree with me on that, but I found that I found a passage where he says, "Nature cannot give movement to animals without mechanical instruments." And so to study the movement of the animal body and the human body, he had to use mechanics. And this was his main reason why he studied mechanics. He actually called mechanics a noble science because it allows us to understand the movement of the human body. So to study the movement of bodies, he had to study mechanics, but for him that didn't mean that bodies were machines. They had mechanical parts, mechanical functions, but the source of the movement, according to Leonardo, comes from the soul, which is not mechanical, not even material, which is spiritual.
Hmm. So do you think that some of his approach in the design of mechanical devices owes something to his understanding of body mechanics and taking that kind of understanding and perhaps grafting it onto the idea of how do we build a mechanical device, a non-living thing to perform an action?
Yes, I think so. Well, this is especially true for his flying machines, which, by the way, many of them were aerodynamically completely sound, and he would have been able to fly with them by flapping artificial wings. The only reason why he couldn't, the main reason, was that the materials he had at his disposal were far too heavy. You know, these, you know, woods and leather and cloth and ropes, and human muscle power is just not strong enough to lift these heavy machines, which he himself recognized. If you built them today with aluminum and plastics, you could fly with these machines. And actually, a glider has recently been built in England in a few years ago, where British engineers followed Leonardo's instructions and could fly this glider. It flew perfectly well. So yes, he used his knowledge of anatomy and combined it with his knowledge of mechanics and engineering, linking the two fields of animal physiology and engineering. And by the way, when I say animal physiology, I refer to the fact that Leonardo always refers to the human body as an animal body, as we do today in biology. But this is another statement that would have got him in trouble with the Pope, I'm sure.
Yeah. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that Leonardo was, in many ways, the embodiment of this ideal of his time, the universal man. That is the person who is educated in all of the fields of endeavor. And it could be indeed that while that would have been challenging at that time, perhaps one could think more of the fact that it could be possible that one could be a scientist and interested in, experienced in medicine and understand the body, and also be a painter and a sculptor and an inventor and an architect and all of the various things. And certainly one of the big differences between that time and this is that now all of the various fields that we're talking about have been fractured and divided from one another and compartmentalized. And it seems that's also why it's more difficult to think about whether someone could actually be that kind of a person now.
Certainly. I mean, knowledge is much more extensive today. Science is much larger. And we couldn't go into a comparable depth in all those fields. A single person couldn't. But what we can do and what we need to do is to recognize how these various fields are interrelated. And this is why Leonardo's legacy, I find, is so important for today. Today, our sciences and technologies have become ever more fragmented and separated, unable to recognize our multifaceted problems from an interdisciplinary perspective. Mm-hmm. So we need to regain this perspective. We need to recognize the interdependence of all natural phenomena. To use a popular phrase, Leonardo can teach us how to connect the dots. And that is very important, not only in science, but also in today's politics and civic life. Mm. So Leonardo can be an inspiration to us.
So perhaps at least then, if we can't, we might aspire to being the universal man, and not to say that a woman couldn't, the universal person, I guess maybe now we would say. And so that maybe that's something that we could aspire to, but now perhaps the way to do it is we build these research institutions where at least what we try to do is we gather people from different disciplines all together, at least in the same place, and
yes,
let them hang out together and talk with one another and have a kind of develop a kind of a mind, in a sense, that's made of these different parts that brings the different disciplines together.
Absolutely.
But I am really interested in this idea that one could try to at least have that as a goal, something that you would work toward, and having a mind that is that open, that curious, that reaches out into that many different directions and makes connections between things that perhaps might otherwise seem to be
separate.
Yes,
and I think we can do that, and there are generalists today who are not experts in you know individual fields, but who see how various fields are connected. The whole development of complexity theory, of the theory of living systems, those are sort of general theories that lead in that direction.
Well, I think we are just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. Just any last sort of thought that you might like to leave with the people?
No, I think we covered an enormous amount, and this was really inspiring for me. And I thank you very much, David. It was a tremendous pleasure.
Well, I thank you. A great pleasure for me, too. For people who are listening, if you'd like to read this book, and certainly there's much more in this book than we've covered here in this short conversation, the book to look for is The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance by our guest, Krzysztof Capra. It's published by Doubleday. He is the founding director of the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley, California, and author of a number of books. You might go out and look for them. His others, The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, Uncommon Wisdom, The Web of Life. Dr. Capra, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.